Good morning. My name is Divine. This is episode 218 of the Divine Intervention Podcast. And in today's podcast, I'll be continuing the comprehensive microbiology review series for the USMLE Step 1 exam. This will be episode 218, and I'm going to be talking about the viruses. So let's jump right into it. So the thing is, and I'm actually going to be trying something new at the end. I will just maybe spend like a minute talking about like a life lesson that's useful for like med students and professionals in healthcare. And, you know, hopefully you find that to be, you know, helpful just kind of going forward. So let's just get right into it. So you kind of want to know some basics about viruses. And unfortunately, one of the things with viruses is there's a lot of memorization associated with it. So I try to kind of come up with some rules that should be able to help you quite significantly with kind of grouping things together. Really, micro is about like just being able to group things appropriately. If you can group things well, then you can remember a lot of the information. And it's also useful to know things in a clinical context. So if you notice from the first two installments in the series, I try to be as clinical in my presentation of micro, because I feel like those are the things that will ultimately help you do well on the exam. So viruses, right? You can classify some viruses as being either DNA or RNA viruses. You can classify them as being double or single-stranded viruses. And then there are positive and negative sense viruses. The positive sense viruses, essentially, they're mRNA, right? They have the ability to actually infect host cells. The negative sense RNA viruses, again, the negative sense cannot be translated. So the negative sense RNA viruses, you actually need to convert the negative sense strand to a positive sense strand. And you do that with an RNA-dependent RNA polymerase, right? So that means it's an RNA polymerase that depends on RNA as its template, right? So with that, you're able to make like the positive strand, and then that positive sense strand can then go ahead and infect the cell. And the thing is, for the most part, all RNA viruses are single-stranded. There's one notable exception, though, that's rotavirus. Remember, rotavirus is that thing that is the most common cause of diarrhea in kids on MBME exams, and also in the real world, actually, if I'm not mistaken. And then all the DNA virus, remember the D in DNA for the D in double-stranded, right? But again, there's a notable exception, that's ParvoB19, right? That's actually a single-stranded DNA virus that's transmitted via the aerosolized route. And then all the GI viruses, all the arthropod-borne viruses, they are all positive sense RNA viruses. So again, those can directly infect the host cell. And then icosahedral viruses, they could be naked. So that means they have no capsule, right? And if you look at viruses that are helical, they are all encapsulated. And there are some envelope viruses that essentially, there's one thing they do where they use fusion proteins to move from one cell to the other. When they do these things, they're actually able to evade the immune system. And this is potentially why some viruses lead to the formation of multinucleated giant cells, right? So like the herpes virus, for example. Now, the thing is actually, a virus that is non-enveloped, right? This thing is kind of counterintuitive, but it's one of those high-yield things to know for exams. Non-enveloped viruses, they actually end up being sturdier than enveloped viruses, right? So because they are very sturdy, they tend to be transmitted via the fecal oral route, right? So like Hep A and Hep E. I remember A and E are the beginnings and ends. So that's like Hep A is the beginning, Hep E is the end of the hepatitis virus alphabet, right? So that should help you remember that those are transmitted via the oral fecal route, right? So like remember like your mouth and your anus are kind of like the two, like the orifices of your body. I know it's kind of a gross mnemonic, but it's very effective. It will like leave an indelible impression in your mind. So what are some other key things to keep in mind? Again, I've kind of mentioned this already, but repetition always helps, right? So all DNA viruses, they are double-stranded except ParvoB19. Again, remember ParvoB19 is the slap cheek rash deal, and I will say some more things about it later. Causes the slap cheek rash. Excuse me. So it causes the slap cheek rash, and it also can cause like joint pain, like migratory arthritis in elementary school teachers. And then all the RNA viruses, right? They are single-stranded with one exception, rotavirus. And again, like I said, diarrhea in little kids, right? And the thing is, any DNA virus that ends with the letter A has a circular genome, right? That's just one of those rules you can keep in mind. If you have any DNA virus that ends with the letter A, It has a circular genome. All other DNA viruses have linear genomes. And for the most part, most DNA viruses, they actually replicate. They actually replicate like in the nucleus. They typically do not replicate in the cytoplasm. The exception to that is the pox virus, right? The pox virus actually has its own DNA-dependent RNA polymerase, right? So that means it's an RNA polymerase. That means it makes RNA, but it's dependent on DNA as the template. And the thing is, all DNA viruses, again, they are enveloped, but with some key exceptions, right? So we have like parvovirus, adenovirus, and the papoviruses, right? And then most of the DNA viruses, they actually get their envelopes from the plasma membrane. But there are some key exceptions here. The herpes virus actually gets its envelope from the nucleus, and Hep B, right? Remember, Hep B is the one that tends to be transmitted via like sexual intercourse. It actually gets its envelope from the endoplasmic reticulum. Again, I know some of you may be saying, Divine, this stuff you're talking about super low yield, but I promise you it's super high yield to know for the exam. So I decided to kind of make like a table that emphasizes some key classifications, because sometimes one thing your friends at the MBA may do is they'll write a question about like a virus, and then the answer, like, you know what the virus is, but they will now start writing answers that say single-stranded positive RNA, blah, 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 right? So I kind of tried to divide them for you and put the high-yield viruses under these nice and easier categories, right? So the RNA viruses, for the most part, they tend to be icosahedral. You can have those that are enveloped. You can have those that are non-enveloped. Under the enveloped group, we have those that are positive sense, right? Non-segmented, right? So these are ones that are essentially mRNA. So they can directly infect the nucleus because they can be that positive sense RNA can be translated directly into protein, right? So it's very infective. So under that, we have like the picorna viruses, right? So we have like the rhinovirus. The rhinovirus, remember, it's the most common cause of the common cold. Although, I mean, like, if you've watched the news or if you're existing, you've probably heard about the coronavirus and like the badness that's causing all over the world. And then there's the enteroviruses, they also picornaviruses, and under that we have the poliovirus. Remember, that tends to torch the anterior horn of the spinal cord. We have Hep A. Remember, fecal oral route just has only, remember the A in Hep A for the A in acute, only causes acute infection. And then we also have the Coxsackie viruses. Remember, we have Coxsackie A that causes hand, foot, mouth disease, and then we have Coxsackie B that causes a myocarditis that can ultimately lead to a dilated cardiomyopathy. And then under those, that positive sense non-segmented, again, we have the Calici viruses. And under the Calici viruses, we have hepatitis E. Okay, remember, that's the one that has pretty high mortality in pregnant women. And also, again, fecal oral transmission. And then we have the Norwalk virus, right? That's where we have like norovirus, like diarrhea on cruise ships, stuff like that. Or if you see diarrhea with outbreaks, think about norovirus on MBA exams. And then under those enveloped RNA viruses, we also have the double-stranded or segmented. I would say probably the big one to know there is rotavirus, so I'm going to leave that. And then going back to the very top, like the RNA viruses are, like, again, most of them are icosahedral. We have the non-enveloped. And under that, we have like the single-stranded, non-segmented, positive sense, right? So positive sense are non-segmented. Remember, all the RNA viruses are single-stranded with the exception of rotavirus, right? Rotavirus. So under the non-segmented, positive sense, single-stranded, non-enveloped, we have like the Toga viruses. We have like the Alpha and the Ruby viruses. And then under that, we also have the Flavivirus, right? And that's where we have like Hep C for the most part. And then under the non-enveloped viruses, we also have like, again, the positive sense, diploid. And there we have the retroviruses, right? So like lentivirus is there, like HTLV-1 and 2, right? Those T-cell lymphotropic viruses, they're all there. So just think of kind of like the algorithm that exists in first aid, the gram-negative, gram-positive algorithm. Think of this as an RNA virus algorithm. I will encourage you to commit this to memory. It should help you tremendously on your test. And then I just essentially made the same thing, but I just added some very quick high-yield things here that I think can help you on your test. Just like if you wanted like a very quick rapid review before you take your exam, this slide number 6 is probably a useful one to commit to memory, right? So again, RNA viruses, again, for the most part, they're icosahedral. And under the enveloped, again, we have the single-stranded, positive sense, non-segmented. We have the Toga virus there. And again, these are all enveloped, right? So the Toga virus, we have rubella there. Remember, rubella tends to cause a posterior auricular lymphadenopathy, tends to cause like a 3-day rash. And then the Toga viruses, we also have like the equine encephalitis viruses. Those are like the alpha viruses, if you may. Those are usually transmitted through horses. That's probably the biggest thing you want to know on exams. And then under, again, another group under the positive sense, non-segmented, right, enveloped RNA viruses, we have the flavivirus. Then we have hep C, right? Remember, it can cause hepatocellular carcinoma, tends to be transmitted through like blood transfusions, has the longest incubation period of all the hepatitis viruses, and it's also common in IV drug users, right? We also have the West Nile virus under the flaviviruses. And then we also have like the yellow fever and like the dengue fever. Remember, dengue, right, is transmitted by the Aedes mosquito. And it's the thing that causes like this break back fever, right? And then under the non-enveloped RNA viruses, we have like the positive sense non-segmented, right? And there we have two groups. We have the picornaviruses and the calici viruses. I'll talk about the picornaviruses first. We have rhinovirus. Remember, that's the most common cause of the common cold, right? And it's transmitted via the respiratory route. And then we also have the enteroviruses, right? Under picornaviruses, we have polio. Again, remember, it torches the ventral horn of the spinal cord, so it will cause like a flaccid paralysis, like lower motor neuron symptoms. And it also has fecal oral transmission. Remember, there's the Sabin vaccine. That's the live attenuated vaccine. It's the oral vaccine. Remember, you don't give those to like pregnant women or kids under the age of one on NBME exams. Or if a person is like super immunocompromised, you give the Salk vaccine. That's the killed. So remember the K at the end of Salk for killed, right? That's the one you can, that's the injectable vaccine versus the Sabin vaccine that's actually oral. And then Hep A, right, is also under the enteroviruses. Remember, it has the shortest incubation time of all the hepatitis viruses. Remember, Hep C is the one that has the longest incubation time. And Hep A, right, it's, you know, people can be asymptomatic. They can have like a florid acute hepatitis where their AST, ALTs are in the thousands. You know, usually supportive care fluids. Those people tend to recover pretty well. And there is actually a vaccine available for it. And again, fecal oral transmission, as I've mentioned earlier on. And then we have the Coxsackie viruses, also under the picornaviruses. We have Coxsackie A, hand, foot, mouth disease, Coxsackie B. That's the most common cause of viral myocarditis. I mean, the virus essentially damages the heart and causes like a dilated cardiomyopathy. So the way that I'll present on an NBME exam will be a person that you know, recently had like some upper respiratory symptoms, and now the person is short of breath, has a new S3 heart sound and whatnot, right? And then also under the enteroviruses, we have the echovirus, tends to cause like a viral meningitis. And then again, under that positive sense, non-segmented RNA viruses, the ones that are non-enveloped, we have the calici viruses. Then we have the Norwalk virus, again, cruise ship gastroenteritis, outbreak gastroenteritis. And then we also have Hep E under the calici viruses. Remember, it's really bad in pregnant women. Fecal oral transmission, very common in Asia. So if they give you a question about a person from Thailand or whatever, you know, pregnant woman from Thailand, think about Hep E, right? And then under the non-enveloped RNA viruses, we have the double-stranded segmented. The big one we have there is rotavirus, right? Those are the reoviridae. We have the rotavirus is the most common cause, actually, of a viral gastroenteritis in kids. Tends to have, like, the genomic reassortment. I'll talk about that in a bit. And then, you know, you can also talk about the Colti virus. That's the thing that causes the Colorado tick fever. That's super low yield. Okay, so let's say some high-yield things on the RNA viruses, right? So remember the coronavirus. It's one of those things that you should probably expect to see an increased measure on NBMEs because it has killed so many people in recent times, right? So remember, it's a positive sense, single-stranded RNA virus. Remember, it's the thing that causes SARS, right? So if you remember SARS from back in the day, that was actually caused by the coronavirus. And then don't forget the mumps virus, right? The mumps virus, it's essentially the classic presentation will be a person that has parotiditis, so like, right? And orchitis, so that's like big testicles. It could also cause meningitis, but that's a little lower yield, right? And then measles, right? Measles, right, has the three C's, right? So the cough, coryza. Coryza is just a $5 medical term for runny nose, right? And then conjunctivitis, right? So cough, coryza, and conjunctivitis. And remember that you can also get like coplic spots. I would encourage you to look up pictures of this. Coplic spots on the buccal mucosa. The thing is, it can actually reactivate later in life, and it can actually cause this thing called SSPE. Like a subacute sclerosing panencephalitis. They will talk about a person that, you know, had a history of measles like back in the day and recovered. And then years later, the child is no longer doing super well in school. The child becomes comatose and dies. I mean, like the mortality with SSP is almost 100%. It's pretty bad. And the thing is, if a person is like, you know, going through like a measles prodrome, actually giving vitamin A improves, I think, morbidity. So it actually kind of helps. And then the rabies virus, right? It's from the rhabdovirus family. You know, you can get it through exposure to like animals, like bats, raccoons, dogs. Super long incubation period, and usually travels through like motor neurons, right? So your friends at the NBME, they could probably write like a cell physiology question for this, where you need to remember that, oh, it's kinesin. No, it's dynein, right? Dynein that does retrograde transport, right? So like from the synapse all the way back to the cell body, right? And the thing is, once it gets to your CNS, that's the end, right? That's literally the end. The fatality is like 100%. Usually when you suspect the person has been exposed to rabies, you give them like the rabies immune globulin, and then you also give them the killed vaccine, right? So that they can have both immediate and long-term immunity. And you give those things in separate arms. It's just one of those bizarre things you may see on a test. You don't give it in the same arm because you don't want to give the immune globulin that will bind up the vaccine you're giving the person, right? And all the RNA viruses, again, they replicate in the cytoplasm with the exception of the retroviruses, right? And also the influenza virus. And then don't forget, right? The influenza virus, right, is what causes the flu, not H-flu. H-flu does not cause the flu. I know it's kind of obvious, but it's just one of those things, you know, in the heat of an exam, people can make like spurious mistakes. And the thing is, it's a very segmented virus, right? And it does like a genetic reassortment where essentially, you know, like, let's say you have this one animal and one influenza virus infects that animal. And then some other animal viruses or some other influenza viruses infect the same animal. And then they just mix and mash up like the different segments of their genomes. That's the thing that causes an antigenic shift. Okay. An antigenic shift is super severe, causes severe pandemics, right? So a pandemic, right? Like panic, right? Think of panic, right? So that's usually pretty bad. But if you have like point mutations in the, you know, in the genome, right? Like the genes that code for like hemagglutinin and neuraminidase, right? That's what leads to an antigenic drift. So you see a drift. Causes, you know, for the most part, causes like an epidemic, is less severe. So you see like drift doesn't sound as dramatic as a shift, right? A shift is severe. A drift is not as dramatic, right? And remember, I mean, you probably hear of the influenza virus, like you hear like H1N1 and all that stuff. The H in H1 stands for hemagglutinin. The N in N1 stands for neuraminidase, right? So the thing is, hemagglutinin is actually the molecule that helps the influenza virus attach to the host so they can gain entry, right? So that's like the passport to get into the cell, right? And that's actually what's targeted by the influenza vaccine. And then neuraminidase is essentially the enzyme that cleaves the viral particles, right? Usually the viral particles, they are connected to sialic acid. So you cleave the viral particles from sialic acid so that the cell can leave the host cell it has infected and, you know, go and do its bidding in other cells, right? The thing is, neuraminidase is actually what is targeted by the neuraminidase inhibitors, right? That's a very creative term, like oseltamivir and zanamivir, right? Again, these are all high-yield things to know. And again, I know some of you may be saying, Devon, you don't seem to be talking about pharmacology in these videos. I have very comprehensive podcasts on all the antibiotics and antivirals and antifungals and antiparasitics. I've made podcasts on those. So just go on my website, click on exam topics list, and then you'll see like the different pharmacologies listed there. So I'll just encourage you to do that. And then we have like the parainfluenza virus and the RSV virus, right? So remember, those are the paramyxoviruses. Remember, the parainfluenza virus causes croup, right? Sometimes instead of writing croup on the exam, just to mess with your head, they'll call it like a laryngotracheobronchitis. So if they tell you that a person has like a seal-like barking cough, just, you know, don't bother reading the rest of the question. It's parainfluenza. And essentially, those people have stridor because it's an upper airway problem, right? And it's a subglottic problem. Epiglottitis is above the glottis. It's a supraglottic problem. But croup or laryngotracheobronchitis, the longer name, is a subglottic problem. That's a high yield factor to know, not just for step one, but for your Pete's shelf in 30 and for step two CK. Now, RSV, it's actually the most common cause of bronchiolitis in infants. So if you talk, if you see a question about like viral pneumonia in an infant, like a kid that's like 3 years old or less or thereabouts, and they tell you, oh, you get a chest x-ray, you see interstitial infiltrates, you want to definitely think about RSV. And for the most part, they will have wheezing, right? Because bronchiolitis is a lower airway problem. So lower airway problems tend to present with wheezing. Upper airway problems tend to present with stridor. And one common exam mistake I kind of want to correct here so that you don't make it on a test is like the difference between like rubella, rubeola, and roseola. You see, they sound very similar enough to where people can kind of screw them up on exams, right? So remember, the rubella virus is part of the togovirus family, and it causes German measles, right? That's the thing that's called like a 3D measles. Contrast that with rubella. Rubella is the thing that causes like the legit measles. Like when you hear the term measles, like this is the thing that actually causes measles, right? Remember, it's a rash that starts on the head and kind of moves down towards the toes, right? And then we also have the roseola virus. That's human herpes virus number 6, right? Remember, this tends to cause like fever, causes like a rash in infants. So please don't mix this up on a test. Roseola, the way we'll present is the child will have a very high fever, like 103, 105, like super impressive fever. And then the fever will break. And then like 3 days later, a rash kind of comes up. That's the way to kind of keep that straight. So now let's kind of go to the DNA viruses. I didn't create a chart for the DNA viruses because there's not many of them that you need to know. So it's just probably easier to just go ahead and just remember the quick hits with each one. But basically, we start with adenovirus, right? Adenovirus, right? It's the thing that essentially causes most cases of pink eye, right? So it causes like a conjunctivitis. So if they tell you that a person has pharyngeal conjunctivitis, so like sore throat and pink eye on a test, so conjunctival injection and sore throat, think about adenovirus. Remember, it also causes hemorrhagic cystitis. So they may tell you about like a child at a daycare that has like red urine. If you see that, think about adenovirus. What's the other bug that causes hemorrhagic cystitis on exams? Think about a person from Egypt. I really hope you're going after Schistosoma hematobium, right? And then what's the drug that can cause hemorrhagic cystitis on MBMEs? It's an anti-cancer drug that's also like a risk factor for bladder cancer. I hope you're telling me cyclophosphamide, right? Remember, cyclophosphamide has a metabolite known as acrolein, and that acrolein is a vesicant. It kind of torches the bladder. So that's why you typically give Mesna, right? And you give like a ton of hydration, you irrigate the bladder when a person is taking a cyclophosphamide, right? And then don't forget the pox virus, right? Causes smallpox, and again, it replicates in the cytosol. Now, parvo B19, right? This is a super high yield virus to know about. It's all the DNA viruses are double-stranded with this one exception. It's a single-stranded DNA virus. So parvo B19, it causes FIFth disease, right? Classic presentation on exams, child with a slap cheek rash, right? That has like a rash, has like arthralgias. And the one buzzword you may see on a test is like erythema infectiosum, right? And the thing is, it can also have, in fact, the MBME is beginning to move away from the slapped cheek rash because they know every human being has memorized it. They're beginning to go more towards elementary school teachers, right? So if you see an elementary school teacher that has like migratory joint pain, that's parvo B19 pretty much, right? And again, this is one of those viruses that doesn't leave when you're done with step one, makes a very strong appearance on step 2 CK, on the PEET shelf, on the internal medicine shelf, on step 3. So just something to keep in mind. And the thing is, parvo B19 loves to infect like the erythroid stem cells, right? So it can cause like a pure red cell aplasia. So your hemoglobin, your hematocrit will be super low. Remember, your other like non-red blood cell lines are actually intact for the most part. So like your platelets, your white counts, those are really pretty okay. And the method of transmission, right, is through like respiratory inoculation. And for the most part, if a person gets parvo B19, you know, they will get an anemia from it, but they can usually like overcome the hump. But if you have whatever disorder where like your red blood cells don't live for very long, like thalassemia or sickle cell disease, where your red blood cells live for less than 4 months, for less than 120 days essentially, the thing that will happen is those people can go into an aplastic crisis and die, right? And the thing is, parvo B19, if you get it congenitally, right, that can actually cause hydrops fetalis. I'll talk about the mechanism because hydrops fetalis, many people just memorize the buzzword, but they don't actually understand what in the world that actually means, right? So I'll talk about what that means right now. So the thing is, if, for example, right, your erythroid progenitors are infected with parvo B19, right, they won't work. Well, if they don't work, you're not going to produce red blood cells. So you're going to have an anemia with that. Well, if you have an anemia, the thing is, if you remember the oxygen carrying capacity equation of blood, right, I'll talk about that when I do my POEM, videos / podcasts. Essentially, hemoglobin is part of that thing. So if you have low hemoglobin, right, your oxygen carrying capacity of blood will be decreased, right? Although your P little AO2, so the oxygen tension in your blood, and your SaO2, your hemoglobin saturation of oxygen, will be normal, right? So your oxygen content will go down, right? And because the oxygen content goes down, that will cause hypoxemia, right? And the thing is, when there's hypoxemia, your heart is like your tissues are like, we need more oxygen, we need more oxygen. So let's say every minute your heart does like 60 cycles around the body, your heart will be like, okay, I understand, you need more oxygen, let's maybe do 150 cycles, right? So your heart will keep pumping. The thing is, you know, when you exercise, your heart rate goes up. That's good for that period, right? And, you know, your heart can sustain for that period. But if your heart rate is like super high all the time because you are constantly hypoxic, then the heart can burn out after a while, right? I mean, there is a reason why people have like tachyarrhythmias for prolonged sustained periods. They can get into trouble. There's this thing called like a tachycardia-induced cardiomyopathy, right? So the thing is, when the heart, you know, is like working hard, it's almost like you've cast a spell on someone to like work out forever, right? Working out is good, but anything in excess is never good, right? So if you're working out forever, your heart rate is always up and all that stuff, that's bad. After a while, the heart will just kind of like just crap out and just die. It's almost like, just like, okay, I can't take this anymore. I can't keep working at this heart rate, right? You can work hard, but not for super sustained periods, right? So the thing is, if the heart craps out, the heart will, fluid will begin to accumulate because the heart is no longer pumping blood for as well as it should. So fluid will be accumulate in like all the areas of the body and the kid's body will swell, right? That's why it's called hydrops fetalis. It's a swelling of the body of a fetus, right? This is actually a pretty good example of high output heart failure. In fact, I can foresee your friends at the MBME writing a question where instead of putting hydrops fetalis, or they can ask for the mechanism behind hydrops fetalis, it's an example of high output heart failure. I'll say some more things about high output heart failure in my cardiology videos in the future. Now, so HPV, right, that's another high yield DNA virus, causes cervical cancer, causes squamous cell cancer of the cervix. Remember, there are low risk and high risk HPVs, right? There's like HPV 1 and 6 that tends to cause like plantar warts, 6 and 11 causes genital warts. And then those in the teens and in the 30s, right, like 16, 18, those in the 30s, those tend to cause a cervical cancer, right? And remember the screening guidelines, right? You essentially need to, you can give, sorry, the vaccination guidelines. You can start giving the vaccine as early as the age of 9 these days on MBME exams, right? So that's just one of those things you want to file away in your memory. And remember the genital warts, right? They are called condyloma acuminata. Please don't mix it up with condyloma lata. Remember, condyloma lata is like the secondary, is one of the findings in secondary syphilis, right? Just one of those things, again, you don't want to mix up on your test. And the mechanism behind HPV 16 and 18 causing problems is they express these proteins called E6 and E7. The thing is, your friends at the MBME, they love E6 and E7 for cell biology correlates that they have. The thing is, E6 is actually a ubiquitin ligase, right? So remember, ubiquitin ligase will put sprinkle a ton of ubiquitins on something. And then when you put all those ubiquitins on something, they are actually targeted to the proteasome for degradation, right? So the thing is, E6 inhibits P53. Remember, P53 is the thing that's mutated in Leaf from an eye syndrome, and then E7 inhibits RB, right? So the thing is, those two proteins are involved in the G1 to S phase transition. So if those things are mutated because they've been destroyed, right? Essentially, the thing that's going to happen is at least the protein products, right? So this is almost like a protein level snafu that happens. If the protein products are polyubiquitinated, destroyed in the proteasome, you're not going to get any effects from those genes because those are actually tumor suppressor genes. So you will have more transition from the G1 to S phase, like unchecked transition from the G1 to S phase, even if you have like a lot of mutations that are built up, right? And that can cause a lot of problems, lots and lots and lots of problems, right? So don't forget, E6 is a ubiquitin ligase. That's a high yield thing to commit to memory for exams. And then the hepatitis viruses, right? So all of them are RNA viruses with the exception of Hep B, where Hep B is a DNA virus. So remember, Hep A is a picornavirus, fecal oral transmission, doesn't progress to chronic hepatitis. Hep B is a hepadna virus, right? So it's a DNA virus. I remember that like hepad DNA virus. I don't know if that helps you remember that. Again, sexual contact for the most part, kind of ignore the IV drug use business, although it can be transmitted by IV drug use actually. So it can become chronic, and again, it increases risk for hepatocellular carcinoma. So actually the Hep B vaccine is actually one of those vaccines that have been shown to decrease the risk of cancer, right? That can be a very simple question that your friends at the MBME can actually ask you, right? excuse me. The HPV vaccine is also, again, one of those anti-cancer vaccines, essentially, right? And the thing is, Hep B is vaccine preventable, right, as I've mentioned. And the thing is, if a fetus acquires it in utero, that fetus has almost like, I think like a 95% chance of progressing to chronic infection. But if a person acquires HEB as an adult, I think the chance of progressing from acute to chronic infection is defined by timelines. You have like persistent infection at more than 6 months. Those people, I think, have like a 5% risk, right? So you see that there are differences in the rates of progression to chronic infection depending on the age or the period in life when a person gets the Hep B virus, right? And again, if a person is at risk, you know, just give the Hep B vaccine and also give the Hep B immune globulin. And again, give those in separate arms, right? In fact, the Hep B vaccine is one of those vaccines that kids get before they even leave the hospital, right? And again, if someone has been, because there's this classic MBME question that pops up. If a person has been stuck by a needle, and that needle is, you know, from a patient that has had like Hep B, if the person is known, the person that was stuck with the needle, if the person is known to already be immune to Hep B, you don't need to give Hep B immune globulin, you don't need to do anything, right? And then remember, Hep C is a flavivirus, sexual contact, but for the most part, think of IV drug use, blood transfusions on your test. Highest risk of progression to like chronic infection, so it can cause cirrhosis, it can cause HCC. Remember, the HCC tumor marker is AFP, right? Remember, AFP is also the tumor marker for the yolk sac tumor. It's one of those gonadal malignancies. Sometimes you see it referred to as the endodermal sinus tumor. And you can actually treat Hep C. You can actually cure these days with like super expensive drugs like sofosbuvir, like dipasvir, all that stuff. There's many of them. They're like the direct acting agents. I talk about those in my pharmacology podcast for Micro. And then Hep D, remember the D in Hep D for dependent, right? It's dependent on Hep B for infectivity. Essentially, it needs the Hep B surface antigen, right? That's a higher thing to know for exams. And Hep E, right? Fecal oral route, really bad outcomes in like pregnant women, right? And again, I've talked about this Hep A and E, fecal oral, first, last alphabets, whatever's first and last orifices of your body. It's kind of gross, so I'm not going to repeat it again. And then the Hep B serologies, right? So people always find these Hep B serologies to be a pain to learn, right? So let me just teach you a trick that will maybe help you wriggle out through like 99% of the questions without memorizing too many things. Basically, if your Hep B surface antigen is positive, you have infection. That's it. If your Hep B surface antigen is positive, you have infection. That's it. The second rule is, if your Hep B surface antibody is positive, you don't have infection. I'll say that again. If your Hep B surface antibody is positive, you don't have infection, right? So the two rules, rule number one, if your Hep B surface antigen is positive, you have infection. If you have the antigen, it means you have the bug on the inside of you. You have infection. If the antibody is positive, you don't have infection, right? And then you can, if you go off of that, you can usually reason out the rest of the stuff pretty easily, right? So for example, if you notice that, oh, a person's Hep B surface antigen is positive, and then the Hep B core antibody is positive, right? And you notice that, oh, it's IgM. You know it's an acute infection. The fact that the Hep B surface antigen is positive means there is infection. The fact that the Hep B core antibody is positive and it's IgM means it's acute infection. If it's IgG, it's chronic infection, right? But if you notice, if you get a question that, oh, the Hep B surface antibody is positive, it means no infection. Well, if you check and the core antibody is positive, it means the person was infected before and recovered. But if the core antibody is negative, it means that the person was never infected and the person was just vaccinated against Hep B, right? And then the other one, weird one, where, oh, it's just the core antibodies that's positive, like the surface antigen is negative, the surface antibody is negative, that's the window period, right? That's pretty much it for the Hep B serologies. If you just follow these rules, you don't have to memorize much. It just makes your life like super easy on exams. And then the herpes viruses, right? So let's kind of talk about these real quick, right? So we have like HHV1, that's HSV1, right? Causes herpes labialis, so like oral herpes. It could also cause genital herpes as well, right? So don't completely hold that to heart that, oh, the mind said that HHV1 only causes oral herpes. That's not true. It can also cause genital herpes. In fact, MBME questions have been known to show up where it was a genital herpes question and the correct answer was HSV1. But it didn't put HSV2 as an answer, right? But basically, HSV is what causes oral or genital herpes. And the HSV2, again, is the most common cause of genital herpes. But again, remember, it could also cause oral herpes. And then HHV3, that's VZV, that's varicella, right? Causes chickenpox in the primary childhood infection, shingles for the older individual, right? Remember, the neuropathic pain from shingles, you can kind of treat it with like a tricyclic antidepressant, or you can use like gabapentin or pregabalin, right? And again, a buzzword, people have like pain and vesicles in a dermatomal distribution. If you see that, think about HHV3. And then HHV4, that's EBV, right? Causes mono, right? Causes infectious mononucleosis. The high yield history will be a young person. I've never seen old people on NBMEs get EBV, right? Because old people on NBMEs, I'm not saying the real world, but on NBMEs, classically do not participate in like risky sexual behaviors, right? So if you see a sexually active young person, has cervical lymphadenopathy, sore throat, and the cervical lymphadenopathy, don't just be fixated on, oh, it's got to be posterior. It can actually be anterior on an NBME, right? So if you see a young person with lymphadenopathy, sore throat and splenomegaly, that's EBV on your test, right? And the thing is, the virus remains latent in B cells, and it gets in through CD21 into cells, right? So the thing is, because it infects B cells, right? It's a virus that's infecting cells. Your cell-mediated immunity will try to act against it, right? So you have a proliferation of atypical T cells, right? They are called Downy cells. They are CD8 positive on a blood smear, right? And again, it remains latent in B cells, right? And remember that it causes a monospot positive mononucleosis syndrome. Those people need to avoid contact sports for a while so they don't rupture their spleens, right? The reason why their spleens distend is because, again, the periarteriolar lymphatic sheath, the pars region of the spleen, expands, right, to proliferate those Downy cells, right? So they can ask you the mechanism behind the splenomegaly. That's one thing you want to keep in mind on your test. And the HHV5, that's CMV, right? Tends to be transmitted through like renal transplants, blood transfusions. You can also transmit it in utero, right? So if you get a question about an infant that has like hepatomegaly, has a blueberry muffin rash, and then here's the classic super high yield thing for exams. Periventricular calcifications on imaging of the brain. If you see that, stop reading the question, that's CMV. And remember, it can also cause like colitis and retinitis in like HIV patients, or again, like post-transplant recipients, right? I know people may say, Devon, you're saying recipients. That's actually how it's pronounced. It's not pronounced as recipients. Recipients is actually the wrong pronunciation. That's one of the things I'm actually pretty good at. I'm pretty good at English. Okay. And again, the virus remains latent in like your mononuclear system, and it causes a monospot negative mononucleosis-like syndrome. And the HHV6 roseola, already talked about that. That's exanthem subidum. That's sixth disease. And then HHV8, Kaposi sarcoma, right? Remember, look up pictures of Kaposi sarcoma online. That's a classic thing they tend to put on exams, right? And then, again, most viruses, they get their envelope from the cell membrane. But remember, herpes gets its envelope from the nuclear membrane. So, again, that's kind of high yield to know for exams. So, let's just run through some quick triggers to kind of wrap this up. So, and I'll run through these. And again, you don't need to write these down. The answer is on the following slide. But let's run through these real quick. Just use these to quiz yourself. So, a rash with a slap cheek appearance, right? That's Pavo B19, right? Cough, coryza, conjunctivitis, plus coplic spots, that's measles, right? A descending maculopapular rash, that's also measles, right? Gastroenteritis and eventual paralysis, that's polio, right? Remember, polio is one of those enteroviruses. If you see cervical cancer in the sexually active, that's HPV 16 and 18. Parotiditis, orchitis, and male sterility, that's the mumps virus, right? Remember, it's a live attenuated virus. If you see cataracts and blindness in a newborn, right? Think about rubella. Remember, rubella can also cause like a pathogen ductus arteriosus as well, right? So that's like the congenital rubella syndrome. And then if you see like painful skin lesions in a dermatomal pattern, that's HHV3, right? That's varicella zoster virus. Virus that remains dormant in the dorsal root ganglion, that's also VZV. Retinitis in an AIDS patient, that should be what? CMV, I hope you're saying that. And don't worry, I'll be done with this podcast pretty quickly because I have to run for a meeting pretty soon. Genital warts, right, that's HPV 6 and 11. Painful vesicles on the genitals, that's HSV 2, right, but it could also be HSV 1. Hepatitis in a pregnant woman with high mortality, that's Hep E, okay? And then gastroenteritis on a cruise ship, that's norovirus, that's normal virus, pretty easy. And then fatigue, splenomegaly, and atypical lymphocytes on a blood smear in a young person, that's EBV, that's HHV4. Childhood gastroenteritis, remember that's the only double-stranded RNA virus, that's rotavirus, right? And then two common causes of the common cold, that's coronavirus and rhinovirus. Now, rhinovirus is the most common. Bronchiolitis in an infant, that's RSV, right? Segmented genome plus epidemic shift pneumonia, that's the influenza virus, right? And then animal bite plus fatal encephalitis, that's rabies. And then encephalitis in a neonate, there's many things, but you know, it can be like a HSV, especially when they have like bloody CSF, like CSF that has like a crap ton of red blood cells. Next one, so a 75-year-old man is being evaluated for a 3-day history of productive cough, fever, and chills. The medical student on service collects some of the patient's rust-colored phlegm for evaluation prior to beginning empiric treatment. Physical exam reveals a febrile patient with a temperature of 103 degrees Fahrenheit. and crackles in the right lower posterior lung field. Which of the following best explains a key virulence factor associated with the offending organism? So what do you think the answer is? So what bug am I referring to here? It's strep pneumo, right? Remember, strep pneumo really torches like mucosal surfaces, like your respiratory mucosa. So it would make sense that it should have like an offensive weapon against the antibodies that guides your mucosa. In this case, IgA, right? So it has an IgA protease, right? Remember, Ig is a dimer, right? So the answer here is option D. Remember, this is just one nice way that the MBME can integrate immunology and microbiology. They love to make those integrations on exams. Okay, and again, strep pneumo treated with ceftriaxone. Remember, it's a third gen cephalosporin. So I'm going to keep going. And then other quick questions here, right? So neonatal encephalitis from a mom that handles cats. I hope you're thinking about like toxoplasma, right? Bloody diarrhea from undercooked chicken. That's Campylobacter jejuni, right? It's the most common cause of bloody diarrhea in the US. Like, you know, infectious cause of bloody diarrhea. Remember, it can also cause Guillain-Barré syndrome, right? And then hyaluronic acid capsule with M protein, right? That's strep pyogenes, that's group A strep. Ataxia and loss of sensation in a sexually active female, right? Ataxia, loss of sensation. You know, maybe think about syphilis, like Tabes dorsalis, tertiary syphilis. Encephalitis weeks after consuming undercooked pork. That's like neurocystis or cirrhosis from like Tinea solium. And then CT scan shows ring-enhancing lesions in the brain of a HIV patient. That's toxoplasmosis as well. If you see a single lesion, it could be toxo, but it could also be a primary CNS lymphoma. Bloody diarrhea and hepatomegaly, like a liver abscess, unless they tell you that this liver abscess has an anchovy paste consistency, that's Entamoeba histolytica. Remember, that is treated with metronidazole. And then AFB staining the stool sample of an AIDS patient, like diarrhea in an AIDS patient, that's cryptosporidium. I remember, you can treat that with paromomycin or nitazoxanide. And then sexually active male with arthritis and skin petechiae, that's gonorrhea, that's pretty easy. Inflammation of the testicles and parotids, that's the mumps virus. Sickle cell patient with super low hemoglobin, think about PARVO-B19, aplastic crisis, right? And then permanent flaccid paralysis in an unvaccinated child, maybe from like California or like some West Coast state. Sorry, it's just again a classic presentation. Think about polio. And then nuchal rigidity in a 2-week-old child. That would be group B strep. Right? Remember, group B strep or strep A galactiae is the most common cause of any notable infection in the first 20 days of life. And then most common bacterial cause of STDs in the US is what? Is chlamydia, right? And then most common cause of UTIs in the US is E. coli. Second most common cause, I hope you know, is Staph saprophyticus, right? And there's this bug, Uroplasma uroleticum, that the MBME is beginning to care about. So kind of like make sure you know about that. It's a urease positive bug, so it can cause like, it can cause many things like premature labor and delivery. It will cause a UTI with like a super high urinary pH, so it can cause those strobite stones on tests. But it's not here. I don't mention it here. I think I may have mentioned it earlier or something somewhere. And then elevated liver enzymes in a pregnant woman that subsequently dies, that's Hep E, right? And then genetic property associated with a worldwide influenza epidemic or pandemic, that's like reassortment, right? Viral conjunctivitis, like pharyngeal conjunctivitis, that's adenovirus, right? Black hair scar in a diabetic, right? That's ecthyma gangrenosum, that's going to be Pseudomonas. Viral myocarditis, that's Coxsackie B. Remember, Coxsackie A is hand-foot-mouth disease. And then flu-like symptoms after visiting Hawaii is leptospirosis, right? So Leptospira interrogans. Remember, it's a spirochete, so you can see pretty well under dark field microscopy. And then final question here, and then we're done. So cellulitis in a burnt patient. Remember, that bug, that gram-negative that loves wet environments, that's Pseudomonas. Bullseye rash, right? That's Borrelia burgdorferi. That's Lyme disease. Strawberry tongue, that's strep pyogenes, that's scarlet fever, right? Strawberry cervix, right? Strawberry cervix is, Trichomonas vaginalis, right? Oops. thereafter returning from Mexico and drinking water, right? So traveler's diarrhea, Montezuma's revenge, that's enterotoxigenic E. coli. And then maculopapular rash, a few weeks after returning from spring break. So think of maybe like, you know, maybe it's a rash on the palms and soles. It can be like secondary syphilis, you know, stuff people do on spring break. Again, I'm not saying everyone does that stuff on spring break, but you know what I mean. Fever, nuchal rigidity, altered mental status, you know, maybe think about Neisseria meningitidis. Meningitis in a college student, right? That'll be Neisseria meningitidis. Next best step in the management of a patient with nuchal rigidity. If they don't have signs of increased intracranial pressures, you can strongly consider getting like lumbar puncture, right? But you do a CT scan first if you have signs of increased ICP, because if you do a lumbar puncture in a person with high ICP, they'll herniate and die, and that's not ideal, right? And then meningitis in an older individual, think about strep pneumo. Meningitis in an unimmunized infant, think about, I don't know what I was thinking about with this question. I'm not really sure what I was thinking about there. And then drug of choice in the treatment of Neisseria meningitis, that's ceftriaxone. And then meningitis in a neonate, that's going to be group B strep. Apparently, I was thinking about like Neisseria meningitis or H influenza, yeah? Because those are both vaccine preventable. So I'm going to go ahead and stop here. As I do at the end of every podcast, I do offer one-on-one tutoring for many exams. Step 1, 2CK, 2CS, Step 3, preclinical med school exams, 30 shelf exams. If you're a medicine or PEDS resident, like your in-training exam or your board exam, I offer tutoring for all those things. If you're a college student that needs tutoring for like the pre-med subjects, Gen Chem, O-Chem, Physics, Biochem, Histology, Physiology, basically the MCAT subjects, I tutor to those. And then if you're a college student applying to med school, so like an AMCAS app, or a med student applying to like residency, so like an ERAS app, I do offer like one-on-one advising, or you can call it coaching for those exams. And again, many of the people I've worked with, they've been like super, super successful. For the most part, they've pretty much all matched their first choices. And then I also offer these booster courses. It's 15 hours for Step 2 CK and Step 3, and 20 hours for Step 1. So if you're interested in that, just reach out to me. Essentially, it's a Q&A, very rapid review, must-knows, clinical presentations for these exams. And again, the vast majority of people I've done this thing with, they found it to be super helpful. And then one other thing I would say is please subscribe to the podcast app. You can find to the podcast. It's on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Google Play. And also please subscribe to this YouTube channel. So thank you for listening. I really appreciate it. The life lesson I want to give you today is essentially just being a hardworking person, right? Hard work is called hard work for a reason, right? But the thing is, if you work hard and you're willing to delay gratification, success is possible, right? But if you're an instant gratification person, you won't look towards the future in the things you're doing, right? So don't concentrate on the present. Don't just give up like your future crown for like some present enjoyment, right? So if you know you have Step 1 coming up a year from now, start preparing for that exam, because the way you perform on that exam kind of determines a pretty big chunk of your future as a person in medicine, right? So I hope you take this lesson to heart. I hope you find it to be helpful. I'll see you in the next podcast. Thank you for listening. God bless you.